Welcome to Reading, Writing, Rolling, Imagination and Fiction in the Age of Harry Potter. This is episode 12, where we will be talking with Emily Strand about galaxies not so far away, Star Wars, and Harry Potter. Katie McDaniel, professor of history at Marietta College and co-editor of Harry Potter for Nerds 2. Our resident expert is John Granger, the Dean of Harry Potter Scholars and author of numerous books about the Harry Potter series, including the Deathly Hallows Lectures. Well, John, school is out for summer at our house. How about you?
Yes, school is out. I finished my first class at UCO about Harry Potter, of all things, and it was a blast.
Oh, wonderful. Cool. Our special guest today is our dear friend, Emily Strand, instructor in comparative religions at Mount Carmel College of Nursing in Columbus, Ohio, not too far away from me. Ohio!
Yay!
She was one of the contributors to the Harry Potter for Nerds 2 collection with her chapter on Quidditch as a symbol set in the Harry Potter series. And she's also the author of the book Mass 101, Liturgy and Life. Emily was on our first show from the Roanoke Harry Potter Festival and also appeared on our show about the Chestnut Hill Harry Potter Conference in October. She's a student at the Mythgard Institute right now, taking our other friend Amy Sturgis's science fiction course. Thanks for joining us again on the show, Emily.
Well, you're very welcome, and thank you for having me. It is always a great pleasure to be with you and John and to thoroughly nerd out about Harry Potter.
Oh yeah, that's right.
It's I was just explaining to somebody what this podcast is all about, and that's the best explanation I can give it. It's a thorough nerding.
I like that. I embrace it. Yes.
Yeah.
Well, we are thick in the season of new Star Wars movies. In the past few years, we've had The Force Awakens, Rogue One, The Last Jedi, most recently the Solo movie, which Emily and I have both recently seen and are excited about. And there's another movie due out next year. A little mysterious, that one.
Yes.
Meanwhile, we are also seeing a similar abundance of Wizarding World film and theater experiences, with, of course, The Cursed Child, which is in both London and is now in New York City, and also the Fantastic Beasts movies. So there's a lot of overlap in the two fandoms. Between the Star Wars fans and the Harry Potter fans, there is in your Venn diagram, there is a fair overlap between those two groups. And today we're going to try to become more aware of the ways that these two series reflect or influence each other, or important insights that we can get from looking at them together. So, Emily, as a member of both fan worlds, tell us, how did you get interested in the Star Wars series, and do you think your love for the Harry Potter stories is related to that interest?
Well, I can answer that with a resounding yes, because I will credit Harry Potter with getting me interested in all kinds of speculative fiction media. So I was a reader of the classics, you know, and that included a lot of Jane Austen and the Brontes, things like that.
Those are good choices.
Yeah. Yes, right. And now I kind of come to understand those as in some ways kind of speculative, especially the Brontes usually have some element of the supernatural in their books. And Jane Austen's works are so thoroughly kind of Victorian that they kind of play in this alternate world as well. So a lot of people do kind of count those as speculative fiction. But I really read more realistic stories. And then I was in graduate school and somebody handed me the first three Harry Potter books and said, oh, those will be a nice little break for you. You'll just, you know, and I devoured them. I was just really interested, just enjoyed how fun they were and how British they were. And And then, you know, after that, that opened the whole world of fantasy literature to me, which led to immediately to Lord of the Rings and Narnia, and then to so many other fantasy fantasy books. And then and that has led me more recently to Star Wars. You know, Star Wars was just one of those, you know, being involved in the Harry Potter fandom and being, you know, being able to connect with other people about it is just such a great joy and such a great pleasure that I was kind of, you know, I was hearing stuff about Star Wars and I was like, gosh, I just really don't speak that language. I've never really been interested in things with war in the title, you know, because I'm not into war. And so I avoided it. I didn't avoid it, but I didn't get into it for the first, you know, 38 years of my life. And then I heard that Amy Sturgis was going to be teaching a course on it at Mythgard. And so I signed up, and I'm embarrassed to say I only signed up to audit the class because I wasn't sure how much I was going to like Star Wars. And I turned out to be a complete Star Wars nerd. I just had to find that inner nerd on the inside. And thanks to Amy for helping release it. So I will definitely say Harry Potter played a starring role in me eventually finding my way to Star Wars as well.
Oh, that's great. And when you were first reading the Star Wars, I guess you're watching the Star Wars movies, having read the Harry Potter stories, were you already starting to see connections, or was that something that developed a little later?
No, immediately saw connections. I mean, I always consider myself to be a Star Wars fan who was a fan of Harry Potter first. So I see a lot of the things both in the original trilogy and in the prequel trilogies, and now in these sequels, I see a lot of ways in which Harry Potter might have been influenced by Star Wars. Mm-hmm. A lot of similarity, a lot of crossing over, a lot of shared tropes and shared motifs. And then I see in both the prequels and even and especially in these new sequel movies that are coming out, and in the spinoff movies as well, ways in which the Harry Potter phenomenon has definitely influenced Star Wars in the direction that it's heading. So yeah, that was just, I mean, from the first time I watched A New Hope, which I'd seen like parts of it. But as soon as they started playing the, what's it called? It's called Djarik, the game mm-hmm. that they play on the Millennium Falcon, which is also featured in the new Solo movie. I was like, what is that, alien wizard chess? Like, that's weird. Do they know that that's just wizard chess with aliens? You know, so, you know, it was one of those things where I was like, oh, well, clearly that's where this wizard chess thing came from. Hmm. So I definitely saw all these things with very much of a Harry Potter colored glasses on.
That's really interesting. And I love that you feel like you can see the influence kind of going both ways.
Oh, definitely.
So even before the latest round of movies, you have been looking at the connections between Star Wars and Harry Potter, and you actually gave a talk that was talking some about those similarities at the Chestnut Hill Harry Potter Conference last year. Is that right?
I did, yes.
And so what are some of the most important connections that you think, you know, that as fans of both worlds or even just one or the other, you know, are important to pay attention to?
Yeah, there's a lot, actually. And so the first thing, if I may, I'll just refer your listeners to an old MuggleNet Academia show, number 41, called Lightsabers and Wands.
Right.
And that was, yeah, that was the time that we first talked about the kind of the crossover. And again, you know, Star Wars is just coming up with this big reboot that was started in 2015 with The Force Awakens, and with the sale of Lucas of Star Wars to Disney in 2012. And then now we've got this reboot and all these new stories that are coming out. So it was a great time to talk about, you know, the crossover there. So we talked for a long time, and Amy Sturgis was part of that podcast, and that was a great conversation. So the full thing is there. So that's kind of like the prequel to our conversation tonight. So I encourage folks to listen to that. Briefly, I will say one of the things we talked about is just if you look at dates, you know, the Star Wars movies, the first Star Wars movie was released in May of 1977. J.K. Rowling was born in July of 1965, so she would have been 11, almost 12, mm-hmm. when that movie came out. And you know, that's a really magical age. Mm-hmm. And I mean that that double entendre is on purpose, you know, because we know that even Joe thinks it's a magical age, because that is, of course, the age across which the new students cross the lake to Hogwarts and start their magical education. So it's, you know, she was at this really, and it's also the age at which she was baptized into the Christian church at her own request. So we know that I'd love to hear Jo talk more about age 11 for her and what that was like. But there was, you know, the Star Wars sort of swept a lot of the world at that time, especially in the year that followed. And so I don't know how she could have missed that phenomenon, being that age and it being such a huge hit. So then, of course, we have the subsequent movies in 1980 and 1983. So throughout kind of her childhood, mm-hmm. 18 or, you know, 11 to 17. So then The Phantom, then we have this big gap, and then The Phantom Menace, the first of the prequel trilogy, comes out in 1999. And this is 2 years after Philosopher's Stone was published in 1997. Then, of course, we have Attack of the Clones in 2002, Revenge of the Sith in 2005. And Harry Potter and the Deathly Hallows book is published in 2007. So roughly, I mean, we can really say that the Harry Potter books, and in a small way, even the Harry Potter films, are really contemporaries with the prequel trilogy, because the films, I think their dates are 2001 to 2011. So then we have, of course, the Force Awakens in 2015, and this coincides also with Fantastic Beasts.
Right.
So we're, you know, we think about Star Wars and we think about something that predates Harry Potter by quite a lot, and in some senses that's true, but in some senses it's very contemporary with Harry Potter, and I think that makes a difference. Also, another thing I will mention that we have to pay attention to is, you know, those Harry Potter films were so wildly popular, and they really have changed, you know, they've really set the tone for the film industry mm-hmm. in the age that we live in now. And I think it's very interesting that Alan Horn, who was the chairman, who has been the chairman of Disney Studios since 2012, came straight to that position from the position of COO of Warner Brothers, mm-hmm. which is who produced the Harry Potter film. So I think that those two things are really important to pay attention to. Yeah, and then I found this great article by Cartmell and Whalahan. It's in a book called Books in Motion, Adaptation, Intertextuality, Authorship, and it's all about how the way in which books are adapted for film and TV. And they talk about such interesting... the way that Rowling uses cinematic qualities to tell her story. There's a lot of focus on eyes, and Harry's perspective is very much visually drawn. There's an emphasis on spectatorship.
You mean even in the books, she's doing that.
Exactly.
She's got a real visual quality to her. I think I remember Roger Ebert saying something about when the first Harry Potter movie came out, he said that it was just a real testament to the quality of what J.K. Rowling had done, without a lot of description, that, like, everybody knows what the Gryffindor common room looks like, and that the movie makers make it just exactly what it looks like. And maybe that's part of, you know, that there is a kind of visual quality to her writing as well.
Yeah, very much. And you know, the article, or the authors of that article, suggest that this is the modern rule of film, and this is a rule that is set forth by Star Wars in 1977, and all films afterwards have to kind of pick this up and run with it. But this is, it doesn't just pervade the film industry, but it's also pervading the way that books are written and the way stories are told in general, this very cinematic quality to that. So I thought that was an interesting point that they made. They also, in that article, they made a really striking comparison between the scene in A New Hope where Leia and Luke and Han and Chewie are stuck in the trash compactor, and the Deinoja, I think whatever the animal is called that's, you know, drowning Luke, and the devil's snare scene in Philosopher's Stone. There's a really, like, if you take those two scenes kind of just bit by bit, there's some really interesting parallels that go on between those, and so you can see how that kind of may have inspired that scene, even totally subconsciously. Could have been totally subconsciously. So there's a lot, and then I think even some of the new material that Star Wars has put out, including the TV show Star Wars Rebels, has a very Harry Potterish figure, Ezra Bridger, who's an an orphan, you know, who kind of joins up with this band of rebels. And so he, you know, the first few episodes of that show I watched, I was like, wow, okay, this is Star Wars answer to Harry Potter. You know, this is a character who's really, you know, seems inspired by Harry and his story. And so that way we start to see the influence of Harry Potter on Star Wars, which becomes really interesting to see that as one cultural phenomenon influencing another one.
Rowling has only commented, I think, once on Star Wars, and it was during the great interlibrum before Deathly Hallows, when people were speculating quite openly that that the Dark Lord was Harry's dad, his real father somehow. And he said, "You've all been watching too much Star Wars." That was her dismissal of that.
So people were trying to use the Star Wars series to predict what she was doing, and she was trying to say. Right.
That's right.
Now, I do think one thing that, and maybe, John, you can help us out a little on this, too. There have been some compelling arguments that maybe Star Wars and Harry Potter are coming from similar wellsprings. So, for example, there's the idea of Joseph Campbell's Hero with a Thousand Faces. And then there's also ring composition, and people have applied those theories to both Star Wars and the Harry Potter series, I think, to very good effect.
Yeah, I seriously, this is an important thing, I think. I don't like the Joseph Campbell stuff, because he's mostly about James Joyce, believe it or not. Campbell starts out with that. But he's using Proprian, Vladimir Prop's folklore analysis to come up with a formal structure that he thought was universal. You talk to anthropologists and they laugh about, you know, the so-called universal structure that only exists in Joseph Campbell's imagination. But you do have this formal concern, and Rowling's primary influences, if you will, are C.S. Lewis, Vladimir Nabokov, and J.R. Tolkien, and all of them were formalists. They all believed that, look, the Russian terms are fabula for story and sujet or narration. And that, and Rowling talks about this, actually refers to it inside Silkworm, that the story is the actual time sequence that the reader has to reconstruct from the story as it's told. And the narration is the artistry through which all those things are revealed in time. Mm-hmm. And that's the artistry and, in large part, the meaning and the experience that the person has while putting together the story. Rowling uses these formal aspects, be it the actual structure of the story, you know, the shape of it in terms of ring composition, or the literary alchemy aspects, which are the colors and the texture of the story, which are all subliminal. I mean, unless you're really geeking out here on Hogwarts Professor, you're not looking for that stuff. But you're experiencing it. And like Lewis and Tolkien and Nabokov, she's delivering that kind of powerful experience. Now, Lucas, I have all my stuff on the structure of Star Wars comes entirely from Mike Klimo and his Star Wars ring theory work. He knows his Mary Douglas. He knows his Harry Potter. Mike does. And he says basically all that stuff about the prequel trilogy being a disaster is an absolute misunderstanding of Lucas's formal genius, that he's telling an ABC, C prime, B prime, A prime narrative, and that when he was done with that, he was largely done. He had completed the full set and series as he had conceived it. I know that Amy and Emily are going to break in and say there were supposed to be three others. I'm not going there. But those six films have all the characteristics of a ring structure. The alchemy, I'll leave that for Emily to talk about. But it's that kind of formalist artistry, that it's not so much the story as it is the story and how it's told, giving you the experience. That intentional artistry and focus on structure is something which definitely ties together Rowling and Lucas's work.
And as you say, things that we're not likely to really note on the conscious level, but it affects the way that we understand the story as we're watching it or reading it.
The horrible reception that the prequel trio got speaks to how difficult it is in all media, but certainly in the film medium, to pull off a ring structure over that long a series. Rowling did it in a magisterial fashion with seven books in which each one of the components is a ring and the series as a whole is a ring. That's OCD to the point of needing medication. But it's an experience that if you have read the stories from beginning to end, in one straight shot, you get. I'm not sure. I defer again to Emily here and say, is that true of the Star Wars world? And what I'm especially interested in is there are so many Easter eggs and self-referencing. Mm. This is not intertextual. This is intratextual. These stories all refer to the others. Are the people that have followed on this? Because Lucas is an auteur. He's got all the. I mean, he held the reins pretty much on this series. That obviously was broken when Disney buys it. You know, especially in this latest film. You know, where the director and producer, I don't know how many turnovers they had, it winds up being the 8th or 9th most expensive film ever made because of all the changes. Do we still have that kind of continuity and powerful self-referencing, you know, to throw new lights on the story as it's been told? I don't know.
Yeah, you know, so I mean, I would say a resounding yes to that. To the question of, do we still have this intratextuality? That is really important. I would say yes. That's even there's a lot of eyeballs, you know, on this story as it's progressing at this point. And I mean, I'm not just talking about fan eyeballs. I'm talking about the eyeballs of the people who are creating it. And so, you know, one of the things we talked about in Amy's class on, it was called The Force of Star Wars. It was a great class, and it's still, I think it is available as an anytime audit at Mythgard Institute. So people can go to Mythgard's website and check that out. You could just pay a certain very affordable rate and be able to access all that course material. Well, one of the things we talked about was the ability of Lucas, you know, in that original trilogy, he took an extremely collaborative approach to the script and to the directing and to the way that the films were produced. And in the prequels, 20 years later, he had a much tighter grip, creative grip, on a much more sort of a singular vision for those films. And he did not, because, and he was... He was George Lucas. He was the producer, he was the creator of Star Wars, and he was able to kind of claim his sort of territory, and he didn't have to be as collaborative in the production of those. And the idea, in hindsight, is that the production suffered because he did not have as collaborative of an approach. I mean, in the original trilogy, he had Harrison Ford and Carrie Fisher shaping their dialogue lines. You know, of course, turns out those two are actually quite talented at that. You know, Carrie Fisher went on to be a lot of her career, she was a script doctor, but, and Harrison Ford just had this knack for that character and for pretty much all characters that he's played. But that's the kind of, collaborative atmosphere. And I think that kind of collaborative atmosphere is very much back in some senses with Star Wars from what we can see, because they have, a group of 10 people who are the core group, the folks who are kind of guiding and overseeing all the stories of Star Wars. But the difference now is that it's not out of control. And that was part of when they sold to Disney, when Star Wars was sold to Disney by Lucas. This story group kind of threw out, but they kind of said, the stuff that's come before, all the ancillary materials of, the books and the video games and the board games, everything else that's come, the comic books, those are now going to be kind of in the legends category, so that the kind of continuity of the main Star Wars franchise can be preserved. So in some senses, there's a lot more care being taken now with what goes into these films and how it speaks to the rest of the franchise, and how it affects the rest of the franchise, than we've ever seen. They're quite fastidious about this, and so.
So this is really interesting, because I know, John, one of the things that you find interesting is that J.K. Rowling actually is still, she's writing the Fantastic Beasts movies. She's not getting everything she wants in that regard, but that seems like it's really different from these new Star Wars.
But, well, not so much in terms of what Emily's saying here is that the core group of the screenwriters is such that had a large play in the original six films, outside of Lucas, they're still involved. And what Rowling has done, though, is take that a step further in terms of control. As you can imagine, she had no control over the adaptations of the Harry Potter films, and they're largely a disaster, forgive me. She has not allowed any of her books to be sold to blockbuster film productions. Listen, though she could have sold Casual Vacancy and the Corman Strike series to Warner Brothers in a heartbeat, I'm absolutely certain. Instead, she's made them television productions, and she owns the Bront Studios that produces those television shows. And the Corman Strike books, I believe, are commentaries on the Harry Potter books. I mean, the first three that we have reflect the first three Harry Potter stories, and in a way act as a what those books are really about, and you know, and what you need to be focusing on in terms of her artistry. I mean, Rowling, you know, I make the OCD joke, you know, JKR OCD. I mean, she actually suffered from the conditions she's told us when she was an adolescent girl. I mean, this is not something that she's giving up, right? I mean, she closed off sequels with a play she didn't write, but she just closed off the end of the series. Now she's writing, she's participating in the making of these films, which are largely Lumos and fan servicing projects that will allow her to generate the funds for her legacy, which is Lumos. It's not Harry Potter.
You mean her charity, her
that's
charitable
right.
organization.
The Volant Charities in Lumos is really where Rowling's heart is now, I think. And so she has to have, because Corman Strike wasn't taking off, she has to have something to generate the funds to do things, the miracles that really Lumos is doing in the Ukraine, South America, Africa. I mean, really marvelous, world-changing stuff. That's where Rowling is living. And she, as a screenwriter, she has much more control over what's going on in these films than she did before, when she had to sign off on the films, you know, in their adaptations of the series. Now she's got narrative control somewhat. We'll see how much she really has over the course of these five movies.
Well, you know, that the difficult thing is, it is difficult, especially with something that's unfolding as we speak. And I hesitate to really speak very authoritatively on the way Star Wars is made now. We can kind of gather some things based on what, you know, what we observe and the end result. But it is difficult sometimes to judge the different dynamics that are at work. But you know, I will recommend, if people are interested in these dynamics with the Star Wars movie, the original trilogy versus the prequel trilogy, Chris Taylor's book, How Star Wars Conquered the Universe, would be a great place to look for more information on that. And John, one thing I wanted to break in and ask you about. So when you say that the Harry Potter films were a disaster, so that is just, is that by the John Granger standards in terms of like fidelity to the book? Or, I mean, because they're, I mean, objectively, they were not a disaster. Obviously, they were wildly successful. So that's
In terms of financial success, clearly, yeah, this is one of the greatest
right. Well, financial
of all
and,
time.
And critical success. I mean, you know, they were
they've never won a single Academy Award outside of what Chief Gaffer or something.
You know,
I mean,
I see what you mean.
The films. I mean, the films are formulaic, and they insert. The reason I call it a disaster is what it's done to Harry Potter fandom. Is that the books are no longer the focus of Harry Potter fandom. Any kind of gathering of Harry Potter things is entirely about the film. Not entirely, but is predominantly about the films.
Yeah, I agree with that.
And the experience of the stories that people now have is overwhelmed by their experience of the films. That really the sense experience inside a theater is so concentrated and so without filter that it colors now almost the entire imaginative experience of those who are now coming to this story.
So if, like, for example, you know, I think when I was reading the books, I had a particular image in mind of Hermione Granger, who may in my head have looked quite a bit like me, by the way, bushy hair and all. But I had a particular idea in my head that Emma Watson really does not match up with at all. And yet, I think then when you go back and you read them, you kind of, it's hard even to get back into the original way of thinking about it. Is that kind of what you're talking about, that we have?
Absolutely.
You know,
I mean, Rowling has said that she does not see Daniel Radcliffe as Harry Potter. And as I've said before, that goes into the very thick file of things that are only true of J.K. Rowling. I mean, what person on planet Earth thinks of Harry Potter and does not see the young Daniel Radcliffe?
Yeah, that's hard, especially the young. Yeah, so sometimes when these in the later books, I can kind of separate him just because she's kind of emphasizing that he was tall and he, you know, I'm no offense to Daniel Radcliffe, but you know, he was tall and he was, you know, he just didn't look like Daniel Radcliffe, you know. But I also have a husband who's tall and looks like a grown-up Harry Potter, so there's that,
there
you know.
I got that. Seriously, I think there's a very, I mean, I'm sure Rowling is very grateful to the films in terms of how they fostered the worldwide excitement about her books. She was doing very well though before the films came out. And what has happened consequent to the films is now you see you go to colleges now and give talks as I do, and you find out that there's instead of being 100% familiarity with the books, there's 100% familiarity with the film, maybe 25% familiarity with the books, almost none of the intensity. Most of the students are like, that was my older brothers and sisters thing, as John Mark Reynolds used to say. And that's a disaster. That's a disaster, because now you have this remarkable literary achievement, the artistry and meaning of a just out of the gate author, really unprecedented, I think, in literary history, is now obscured by a popular adaptation that was entirely skewed to appealing to say the Chinese audience. So we have to have a chase scene, or the young boy audience, if you don't like that. I mean, that we've got to have a chase scene in here so we get an adrenaline rush at this point in the film. It's going to be at 37 minutes. You know, I mean, that kind of formulaic storytelling. What's the reason Hollywood just kind of yawned about the Harry Potter films? There wasn't anything really fantastic about them.
Yeah, John, I was going to say, you know, you've talked also about how we know that Fantastic Beasts, as it was delivered as a movie, but also the original screenplay that was published as sort of a book, that's not the original. Like, that's not what she originally came up with, and that probably they had to change what she did. And you have a lot of evidence about things that were taken out of the Fantastic Beasts story that she probably originally wrote, because it had to fit a certain filmic formula that the big studios want to see.
Right. I mean, this is the screenwriter, Steve Kloves, telling her that now it's time to fit the lady to the dress. Uh-huh. She wrote the story, and now it had to be cut and reshaped to fit the necessary formula, the dress. Now, as I sit here with my two feminist friends, how do you like the expression, now it's time to fit the lady to the dress? I mean, that is one of the most ugly phrases. I mean, it's very telling. It says exactly what needs to be said. And Roy made a point of repeating it in the afterword to the screenplay. That essentially, I mean, she's getting her narrative release thing. We're going to see, you know, the remarkable play out of her genius in this script series. I mean, this is a J.K. Rowling story.
To answer your question about what we think of that phrase, I will tell you with some regret that I'm sorry that Star Wars from 1977 onward helped to create that formula, that helped to create that dress that the
absolutely.
Lady has to then
yeah.
be fit.
Absolutely.
So it's not, it's not surprising to me that's your perspective. I mean, I guess I have a slightly different take on the films. I'm not a big proponent of the films in terms of like my own policy in my household is my son has to read all 7 Harry Potter books before he watches a single film. So, you know, most people do one, you know, they read a book and then they let their kid watch the film. I'm like, no, just for the same reasons you've named, John, I don't want him. It's hard enough to keep him away from images of the characters, images of Hogwarts and things like that. I want him to imagine those in his mind. Or at least, you know, let Jim Kay, you know, with his beautiful illustrated versions of Harry Potter, you know,
those
let
are
him,
beautiful.
They are, and they're a little bit more vague. You know, the character spaces and everything are just, you know, they're more kind of archetypal than you know, the specific actors. So you know, that's my policy. But I do see the influence that those films have had on young people, college aged people especially, and older. And I know that the books would not be the phenomenon that they are. The Harry Potter franchise would not be the phenomenon that it is without those films. And, you know, just the way that millennials tend to reference Harry Potter in this just absolutely everyday sort of you know, casual, everybody understands this reference. I don't need to explain what a muggle is. I don't need to explain who Dobby is, you know? I mean, it's just, so, and I'm not saying that that's necessarily a good thing, but it would make me hesitate to call the films a disaster. I mean, I understand you're coming from a literary point of view, but to me, just because it didn't get any Oscars for anything but, you know, set design or whatever, to me doesn't quite
qualify.
Well,
and you do wish more people would actually, you know, read the books and not just see the movies as a stand-in for being able to read the books. I totally, you know, I'm sympathetic with that too, but I understand your point too, Emily. I mean, I think it's a, what is it, like a devil's bargain or something where you sort of think, well,
absolutely,
you know, there's a trade-off.
Absolutely. Rowling said that one of her great frustrations is when people tell her how much they love her work and it turns out they've only seen the movie. Again, let's just look it right in the face. She has not allowed any of her books after Harry Potter to be adapted by a major film company. That is passing up a payday that is not to be believed. And she didn't do it, I'm sure, because she couldn't get the control she wanted over the script.
That's interesting. Yeah. Okay, so I tell you what, this is great. We have lots of things to talk about in terms of you know, the movies, but let's try to get back maybe into the stories. And I think, you know, if we think about how the two are playing out, it's true, we got to think about how one's played out mostly through the films, and it's interesting, the books were sort of the ancillaries, and then the Harry Potter is played out through the books, and then we've just talked about how the movies, you know, they are not the same, right? So it's sort of interesting that those two stories are being told in some different, through some different venues. Emily, I was really interested in a Hogwarts professor post. You are one of the Hogwarts professors. And a post that you had that was called How Fantasy Tyrants Rise. And it was about the rise of Voldemort and the rise of Emperor Palpatine.
Yes.
And you were trying to sort of redeem the prequels. You like the prequels, and you were saying, you know, look, they're very political, and one of the important things about it is the rise of Palpatine, and of course that's a lot of what we're seeing in the Harry Potter arc too. So tell us a little bit about how you think those two compare in these different fantasy universes.
Well, yes, thank you for reminding me about that series that I promised would be a series and has only amounted to two posts. So now, so John knows my eyes are always bigger than my stomach with regard to these posts. I get these great ideas and then I see a butterfly and I follow that. So I'll do my best to try to get back to this series and try to look at some other fantasy tyrants and how they rose to power. So Palpatine, you know, the interesting thing about Palpatine is that he operated within the structures of the bureaucracy of government, whereas Voldemort largely couldn't, unless through an agent. So Palpatine in the prequels, he worked under two identities, Senator Palpatine and then the Phantom Menace, Darth Sidious, you know. Mm-hmm. And these two identities don't really converge until Revenge of the Sith. And even then, Sidious still acts in secret when the deeds are sort of dirty enough, you know, like with he references the plans to the Death Star with Count Dooku, right? At the end of Attack of the Clones. So Voldemort has to use other people as his agents. Uh-huh. Because he is known and understood by the wizarding community at large as at best a controversial figure and at worst a criminal figure. You know, you can't openly, you know, depending on where you're at in history, one can't openly associate with Voldemort and still kind of claim their place in a respectable society. So it's like association with the KKK or with a neo-Nazi group. Like you can't, you know, that's like a cutting off point. You can't associate with these groups and still maintain your respectable reputation.
And,
so,
you know, Emily, I'm thinking too about, like, even in the early days, you know, before the first Wizarding War, you know, mm-hmm. the Minister of Magic, like, that's just not a, glamour position, if you know what I mean. You know, Voldemort is not interested in being a bureaucrat, you know, prime minister or mm-hmm. anything like that. And the positions that Palpatine has are just more, they do have a little bit more glam to them. And so maybe that's also a factor that would even take us even earlier in the Voldemort story before he's, you know, quite such a controversial figure.
That's really true. I hadn't thought about that. You know, Rowling uses so much humor surrounding the structures of power in Harry Potter, especially at first. You know, I mean, one of our first introductions, he doesn't even learn that there is a Ministry of Magic until like a third of the way through Sorcerer's Stone, if later. And then, you know, one of his first interfaces with the Ministry is getting to know Arthur Weasley and finding out that Arthur Weasley is just basically running a gigantic scam, where a personal scam, where he, you know, regulates the misuse of Muggle artifacts.
Right.
And then, but he himself has written himself this loophole that allows him to magically enchant cars, just because he didn't intend to do that at first, you know. So you know, it's treated with a lot of humor. It's not treated with a whole lot of reverence, you know, the political structures. So yeah, I mean, it does make sense that somebody like Voldemort wouldn't really be interested in, you know, this very unglamorous position. That he just wants power. That's not necessarily where the true power lies for him. So it's not necessarily what he's going to go after, unless he's working with a proxy.
And we're thinking about those fantasy tyrants and whether they're coming within the system or outside the system, because of course we know that that happens in real life as well. They can either come from inside or from out, without. Are there any similarities that you see between the two ascents?
I would not, you know, again, that's kind of a barrier between those two. You know, it's hard to, you know, Palpatine's rise to power is modeled, you know, George Lucas was a big fan of history, a big, you know, student of history. And so, you know, Tony Keene wrote in Star Wars and History that Palpatine's rise to power is modeled after Hitler's, Napoleon's, and even Julius Caesar's, because all of these men use the divisive political climate and the kind of crushing inertia of bureaucracy and the fear and frustration that people had with it to gain good favor with the populace and ultimately dictatorial power. And so, of course, cue Padme's famous line from Revenge of the Sith about how liberty dies, you know, so this is how liberty dies, to thunderous applause, you know.
Right.
And it's true, you know, he's given this power by the people. It's supposed to be temporary power, and of course it becomes permanent power. You know, this Voldemort can't really do this. I mean, you know, first of all, he's got no nose, you know. He looks exactly like the snake that he truly is, you know. And the other thing is that Palpatine has much nicer clothes than Voldemort. So, you know, I mean, I think that's kind of a big deal with regard to you know, accruing power. I've seen his robes. I went to the Star Wars costume exhibit when it was in Cincinnati, and his robes are quite fine. I would have voted for anybody wearing those robes. So,
oh my gosh.
So that's a kind of a glib answer to your question, but no, I mean, you know, there isn't a whole lot, you know, besides, you know, gathering the followers. There's more to be said between Voldemort and Palpatine as Darth Sidious. You know, one of the points that Keen makes is that, you know, Palpatine, Sidious, sort of has clout over the banking clan folks, the two guys, the Nemoidians from the prequels, the tall kind of, you know, Asianish sort of guys. He has kind of clout over them because he's got this kind of religious sense about him. And I would definitely say that Voldemort definitely carries himself as this almost religious figure, this presider over the Death Eaters. So there is a similarity there, but again, with Senator Palpatine, we don't have that. It's much more of a strictly secular, political, you know, politician sort of role. But it's fun to look at, and it's fun to think about, and especially in light of the fact that these things have these serious nods to true history. You know, it's interesting to look at these and to compare, to make these compare, have these conversations.
Yeah, absolutely. I think J.K. Rowling is definitely looking to, you know, 20th century fascism and also the communist states of Eastern Europe and what happened there when she's thinking about, you know, what's happening in Book 5, you know, and then how do you bring down these totalitarian regimes, you know, with your small motley band of resistance fighters, that kind of thing. So
absolutely.
I think I can absolutely see that they're, you know, they're drawing from some of the same well of history
in different ways. Yeah,
right. So you have written some about the connection between the movie Rogue One and the new Fantastic Beasts series, and so I wondered if you could share with us a little of your thoughts on the connections that you see between those two movie series, the one movie and then the Fantastic Beasts movie that we've seen so far. And then we're going to try to see if we can predict the future from that. So what do you think? What are the connections? And then can we guess what might happen next in Fantastic Beasts based on that?
Oh,
what
my
do you think?
Goodness. I'm so bad at predictions. I end up being so wrong about predictions. But so I participated in a discussion panel through Mythgard, and it was about Fantastic Beasts and Rogue One, but only in the sense that they came out around the same time. And so we discussed, about six of us got together and discussed both of them. And I can't remember, that is posted online. It was called like One Fantastic Rogue Beast or something like that. And that was a really fun conversation. but I'm not sure how much overlap we discovered. I'd have to go back and listen. And none of it really strikes me in terms of different shared elements. But I think it's kind of a more of a meta sort of observation. The more pertinent connection between those two films seems to be the whole idea of prequel material as a way to eke more content out of a world that's already built. It already has a huge popular following. And plus, you know, these prequels, you know, just, of course, they're a profit-taking endeavor, as John likes to remind us, but they also possess this sort of etiological potential, you know, where, and humans have loved etiologies for forever, you know. Etiologies are stories that give you the explanation for why a thing is.
Oh,
you
sure,
know?
Yeah.
And so we got lots of stories like that in the Bible, you know, all these, you know, for instance, the second story of creation in Genesis, where God doles out the punishments for the sin of the man and the woman. And the woman is going to have pain in childbirth now. And the man is going to have to toil for his produce that grows out of the ground, you know? And so we get these great explanations for why life is the way it is, you know? So people love these etiologies. And so the prequel material that both of these franchises seem to be directing a lot of their attention to gives us some of that. You know, we love to find out where our characters came from, how they got their names, or how they ended up like that, you know, that this character is, we love him for this, but how did he end up like that? So both of these franchises are taking advantage of their ability to tell these prequel stories. And so that's more of a macro level kind of comparison, but I think it's worth noting. And I don't think it's only Harry Potter and Star Wars who are doing this, because my understanding, I'm not a Marvel fan, but my understanding is that Marvel is having a heyday of telling origin stories, and other franchises are kind of dipping back into their rich histories as well. So, right.
Well,
right.
We were just talking about Solo, and that's what Solo is. Solo is just, you know, it's kind of telling you how he got to be Solo, you know, and his backstory, I guess, as they say.
Right. Both in name and in, you know, there's in personality, in his kind of, he's a rogue guy, you know, he's kind of a lawless, but at the same time he does have this instinct for the good, and so the film helps us to know where that comes from and why he has that. So
right, I have to say I did love that whole thing. I mean, you can see why he's a pirate. You know, you can see why that's his. I wouldn't call it profession,
scoundrel.
Maybe a scoundrel, right? And that's the world that he's in, and that's sort of where his skill set is, we might say. But also, like, I just adored the part where Kira says to him, you know, you're the good guy. I think I told you I cried a little bit when she said that. I was like, that's
totally
right, he is a good guy. Right. He allows himself to be vulnerable to people, and that is a character who, especially after you see a lot of the backstory, you think that's a character who probably should know better, but he continually does that, and I just thought that really got that aspect of his character really true.
Yeah, absolutely. I thought Alden Ehrenreich did a great job.
Me too.
With everything, and I mean, somebody I heard recently say that they don't think that he looks like a young Harrison Ford, but I disagree. I think, you know, he's built a little differently, but you know, I think he was really taken time with his body stances and his expressions and his hand gestures. You know, in the end, he kind of does that hand gesture that Han always does, or really Harrison Ford always does, is, you know, he kind of points with this lack of commitment to what he's pointing to, you know. And I'm doing it over and over, but you can't see it. But I was really pleased with the film.
Yeah, and I liked Lando too. I thought Lando kind of stole the show.
Yes, when his droid was not stealing the show.
Oh, yeah. Well, that's true. That's true. I should totally give credit to the droid for that, too. Okay, so let's talk a little bit about The Last Jedi and some of the ways that The Last Jedi is showing that it's been maybe influenced by Harry Potter. And we can sort of see, I mean, the influence, I think, we could see goes both ways. But now The Last Jedi is being produced, you know, post Potter, and so so what are some of the characters and moments that you see as being connected, and where do we see, and you could, I mean, we could think about The Force Awakens too, because of course the characters are a lot of them the same. So what do you think?
You know, this is great. I love checking in with this, and I have kind of a running list of both ways in which they just kind of share these commonalities, and then ways that we can see influence going either direction. So
okay, great.
So and I rewatched. I got about 85% of the way through it last night. So I took notes for this very reason. So the first thing I noticed was we have this urgent evacuation as the way that the story kind of kickstarts. Mm-hmm. And of course, The Last Jedi is the second film in this new sequel trilogy. And it's going to try consciously to try to, as John said, with this, the circular nature, it's going to try to rhyme with Empire in certain ways. Empire Strikes Back, which is the second of the original trilogy. So, of course, Empire has the rebels evacuating their base on Hoth. So here we're evacuating Dakar, and it immediately puts the rebels into flight mode, which they're going to stay in for most of the film of The Last Jedi. And Star Wars has always been really good at this kind of introduction to the story. It kind of places a sense of urgency over the plot right away, and the urgency drives the narrative. So what I saw is it reminded me of the Seven Potters in Deathly Hallows. And how that's a way that that book sort of gets kick-started, because, honestly, Deathly Hallows starts a little slow. So we've got the Dark Lord ascending, which is a very suspenseful, eerie, and intriguing chapter. But then we have In Memoriam, which is a lot of backstory, and we have the Dursleys departing, which is kind of character-driven, tying up loose ends. Mm-hmm. So that's a little bit of a slow start to what is otherwise just a racing roller coaster of a book. Mm-hmm. So as soon as we get to the Seven Potters, the story gets kick-started, because Harry's got to leave home, and they do this evacuation, which doesn't seem very urgent, although everybody's very nervous about it. And as soon as they start the evacuation, it becomes an urgent situation. And so so I thought this was an interesting way to look at these two. I mean, possibly Rowling kind of brought that idea into her narrative, and maybe that helped influence The Last Jedi too. Who knows,
thing that's a quality of, I guess, both The Last Jedi and Empire Strikes Back, and then the last Harry Potter book, is mm-hmm. that you have exile in a way, mm-hmm. right? And you've got Luke but exiled in both of those two movies, right? He's kind of, I say exiled, but right, he's off in the wilderness. Yeah. And then what are Harry, Ron, and Hermione doing for a large part of that book? They're just going from desolate place to desolate place, you know, and sort of figuring things out within that isolation.
Absolutely. Yeah, that definitely shows up in both. I was noticing, the scene in The Last Jedi where Rey looks down off of the cliff into the little bay there, and she can see Luke's X-wing sunk in the water there, and of course that's reminds us immediately of Dagobah with slightly clearer water, so that theme of exile, whether it's self-induced or imposed exile. So that was kind of the first thing I noticed. So then, folks at Hogwarts Professor know that I was very struck when I first watched The Force Awakens by the aesthetic and kind of circumstantial connections between Kylo Ren and Severus Snape.
Kylo Snape, is that a thing? That's called, a thing people say?
Oh yeah, man.
Well, that was the title of my piece. I was very insistent that he was a Snape knockoff. I was like, what is Severus Snape doing in this movie? Seriously. But
hi, Dreamy. Wait, where am I? I just woke up in
in the wrong franchise. But in this film, I'm seeing more similarities between Ren and the character of Draco Malfoy. So first of all, we've got a character with a revered bloodline, you know, which certainly we don't have with Snape. He has a certain reluctance to act in this movie, which is very, very interesting and rather different from what we have in The Force Awakens.
He's ambivalent about his mission.
He's definitely more ambivalent in this film than he was in The Force Awakens. He's got this thoroughgoing nastiness. Of course, we can also attribute that to Snape as well. But, you know, he's got this willingness with his relationship with Snoke, Supreme Leader Snoke. Ren willingly gives his life, his all of his being for this terrible figure who then, at the first sign of failure in his student, answers him with just insult and just put downs. Snoke even at one point tells Ren that he's just a child in a mask. You know, it's striking, and it really reminds me of the way that Voldemort talks to Draco and his family in the chapter The Dark Lord Ascending, which is the first chapter of Deathly Hallows. And it's gonna, you know, for both of these characters, I think it represents a shift. And it's a shift that began for Draco in book six, but begins probably more for Ren here, or maybe even in the moments before he murders his father in The Force Awakens. It begins in those moments. We fans are being asked not just to revile these characters, but to pity them, both with Kylo Ren and with Draco Malfoy. So we're being asked to pity them, and that's going to propel their narrative, their character arc forward, and tell us a little bit about where that character is going to end up. So I said, you know, when I was comparing him to Snape, I said, watch this character for a serious redemption arc. But I would say that that's still true. Even if he's kind of morphing into more of a Draco character, I think that that's still true, of course.
So, you know, one of the things I was trying to think about, because I rewatched it last night too. so I was also sort of thinking about it, and I was thinking about, like, Luke is the teacher and Ben Solo is the student, and and sort of thinking about it like that. But then I thought, well, maybe I should actually not make the Harry Potter exactly connection, but like a cursed child connection. And maybe Kylo Ren is like Albus. He's the guy in the next generation who's inherited, you know, his hotshot dad who he doesn't connect with. And he's got this uncle who thinks he's going dark, right? Just like Albus gets in Slytherin, and that there's maybe something there that's, you know, that's maybe a bit of a parallel between those two.
Yes.
Just a theory.
Yes. Right. I mean, and these things can work in many different directions. You know, we don't have to,
right.
The allegory is no fun. It's, you know, there's no fun in that. But it's more fun to kind of take a step back and say, oh, hey, you know, I mean, like another one is the relationship between Rey and Luke, and the relationship between Harry and Dumbledore. In book seven, of course, Dumbledore's dead in book seven, but still we have this moment where the hero, Harry or Rey, finds out that this legendary, kind of mythic, heroic figure who's such a savior figure is actually a really deeply flawed person who has a terrible secret which has left them just filled with shame. And Harry, of course, doesn't find out about this until about Dumbledore's past, until his death. But it's the same kind, it's a test. It's a test for the hero. And it's whether to trust and have faith in this mentor and what the mentor represents when that faith becomes extremely difficult.
Yeah.
And so the hero is going to have to get through that hurdle in order to move on and progress their own story arc. So I thought that was striking to me.
Cool,
you know,
yeah. I can totally see that.
And people, you know, there's a lot of people who didn't like what they did with Luke's story in this. They wanted Luke to just remain the kind of consummate hero of all time. But, you know, I don't think that's as interesting, honestly, as what they've done
with
this character.
Right, and they've tapped into something that actually is in Luke's character, I think, from the beginning.
Yeah.
I can totally see that. And, you know, Yoda went off and was disillusioned. And, you know, I think maybe it's a Jedi failing.
It's totally a Jedi failing. You know, I mean, Luke is 100% right. And that's the thing that people were so quick to dismiss those prequels. Like John said, I mean, the reaction to them was really pretty bad. You know, it increased a little bit. It got a little bit better as they rolled out. But
if you say Jar Jar to anybody, they start to cringe.
I know. They about smack you across the face, and it's horrible. But the thing that people don't appreciate about those movies, even though they were sort of mired in the politics were really important, and they were telling the story not just of Anakin Skywalker's rise and fall, but of the Jedi Order's rise and fall.
Right.
And a lot, and the, you know, the TV show, the Clone Wars, sort of gave you more of a thumbnail of that period, the Clone Wars period in the Star Wars history, and kind of spelled out, you know, these Jedi who had become, who were peacekeepers. You know, they were literally a religious order who tried to promote peace in the galaxy, had become generals in a war. Mm-hmm. And this became their downfall. And so I did not appreciate the way Luke sort of badmouthed Obi-Wan in The Last Jedi, saying something about it was, you know, a Jedi master who was responsible for the training and creation of Darth Vader. I thought that was a little harsh of Luke to be saying that about Obi-Wan, because I think, I don't know, that kind of got under my skin. But that was the only part. The rest of it, I was like, okay, Luke, okay, he's totally right.
He's
totally
in a bad
right about
place,
all that.
Emily. Luke's in a bad place. I mean, it's a beautiful place, but it's psychologically, he's
been drinking that blue milk. No, the green milk.
Oh, my gosh.
The green milk, right?
Oh, yeah.
He's been drinking that green milk too much. It's addled him a little bit. Not unlike Obi-Wan on Tatooine. So,
well, you know, something that struck me that what you're saying here just reminds me of is that I think, you know, the Harry Potter series, one of the things I love about it is that it takes history seriously. It doesn't start at like ground zero from scratch. There's all this history that has come before that eventually does get revealed, and it turns out to be really important. And I think that the Star Wars movies, obviously, they also have an important sense of history. That's why the people like the etiologies, as you've said, and they're also very historical, and I don't just mean they're making historical references, but they take the history of the universe that they're in very seriously. And one of the things that really struck me is that Kylo Ren really is, he's like a nihilist. He wants to burn everything that came before. Let's start something new. And he says, you know, it's basically you have to let go of the past and you can't be holding on to it anymore. And I was just really interested in that as a response to the historical quality of the series in general.
Yeah, I think that's a really interesting point to it. And that scene was rather ambiguous in terms of, you know, for a second there, I thought Rey was going to take him up on it. And I thought she was going to say, okay, let's start something new, you know, let's have a just galaxy, you know. And I was like, wow, we don't even need a third movie in this trilogy. And they all lived happily ever after. No, and it doesn't even kind of specify how she got away totally and what she did to get away. We just have that really interesting breaking of the weapon. Which is another thing that I noted. We have a broken weapon here. So weapon sentience is sort of something that new that Star Wars has introduced, which definitely seems influenced by Harry Potter. And I can't emphasize that enough, because I have actually heard a member of the Star Wars Lucasfilm story group talking about this, and they actually use the phrase, I can't remember exactly who it was, but it was probably on the Full of Sith podcast. That's a great podcast for Star Wars fans. And they get a lot of great interviews with insiders, so it's nice for good information. But he used the phrase, it's sort of like the wand choosing the wizard. You know, it's okay, so we're consciously borrowing from Harry Potter here. So I don't think it's an unconscious move at all. And of course, you know, because this idea of being chosen or chosenness expressed through a weapon, choosing a hero, that's not original to Harry Potter.
Right.
Obviously, we see it in Arthurian stories and others. And it's, you know, this expression of the role of destiny in the heroes, in the hero's journey. But interestingly, we have this broken weapon in The Last Jedi. Alex Garner from the University of Oregon, she gave a talk at the Ohio State Harry Potter conference that was here a year ago, February. Great talk. And she talked about this broken weapon. She talked about wands in general, weapons in general, but the broken weapon as an important trope in mythic stories, which symbolizes the flaw of the hero that's got to be overcome and usually represents some kind of narrative shift or call to action or new stage on the narrative journey for that hero. So I think this is going to be a really interesting, this is a really interesting moment for Rey, possibly for Kylo Ren as well, but especially interesting for Rey as she moves forward in her hero's journey to find out what this new phase is going to be, and how this, is she going to repair this weapon? Is she going to make herself a new weapon? And what is that flaw in her that this represents, you know? And what has it got to do with what you were saying about breaking the past, you know, breaking free of the past?
Right.
how does that all tie together? That's going to be an interesting question moving forward.
And of course, Harry's broken weapon is it's very important because he has to sort of figure out some things about wands along the way.
Yes.
And it also represents a kind of he has to do something new. And maybe maybe a break with the past. That connection even that he had with Voldemort has been strained. That's interesting. But something that you and I had kind of gone back and forth on was that scene with Rey in the, I don't know, she like falls into the pit and she sees that mirrored surface. And you and I were kind of talking about the Harry Potter connections that that we see there. What do you think's going on there that's sort of Harry Potter-esque?
Well, David Gross, who is a friend of Hogwarts professor and a Chestnut Hill friend who does a great Newt Scamander impression with his beautiful blue coat, he kind of came up with this comparison between that mirror. You know, she looks into this mirror and she asks the mirror to see her parents in the mirror, and the, you know, these two shadows kind of come forward and then they sort of converge and it's just her.
And
of course this is our answer to the question of who's Rey's parents, and the answer is it doesn't matter, they weren't anybody. Don't stop worrying about that, stop asking that question, you know. And so it's really interesting, he's talking about how that really reminded him of the way that the mirror of Erised worked in Harry Potter, where in one hand it showed Harry the deepest desire of his heart, but in another context when he's trying to get the stone, it sort of shows his truest self, which is the self that is going to have the stone but not use the stone. He's going to save the stone from somebody very bad. And so, that was an interesting element, and I did wonder about a Harry Potter sort of influence on that scene.
Right.
So, a brilliant catch by David.
Yeah, that's really cool. And one of the things that I thought about when I saw it was one of my favorite moments, which is in book 3 of Harry Potter, where Harry thinks that he's seen his dad create a Patronus to send away the Dementors, and then later on he realizes that it was himself. And so I sort of was thinking, when Rey just sees nothing but herself, you know, and she it starts with all these multiple selves, and then she says, "Show me my parents," and then she just sees herself. And I thought, to me, that's a similar kind of statement, right? That it's not, you know, your parents aren't related to this, you know, and this is you, it's all you. And especially when Kylo Ren tries to play on her isolation and her disconnection from the past, you know, by sort of encouraging her to just burn the past behind her. But he also tells her, you have no place in this story. Which I think is really interesting, very different from Harry Potter. Harry Potter has always had a place in that story, but she doesn't, right? Or at least that's how he wants her to feel about that. And so her only answer to that can only be herself, that she has a place in a story, not because of ancestry or anything like that. It's just her.
You know, and I think that what we have in this story is going to always be inextricably linked with the time that we live in right now. I mean, as all films are, but especially this one. And I think the historical footnote to this film has got to be the Me Too movement, which has just ripped through Hollywood. Mm-hmm. And, you know, for the Force Awakens got a lot of pushback from certain fans who said, you know, you're never going to be able to sell Star Wars as an action adventure movie that boys are really into with a girl who's a main character.
They didn't even have her as an action figure in one of the packs. Isn't that right?
I know. I know. I don't think it's just a matter of it's because you're a girl. It's because you weren't there in 1977. And there's, you know, so it's both of these things.
Huh.
And I think that because there are plenty of girls back in 1977 who were ape over Star Wars. You know, I believe our friend Amy Sturgis was one of them, right? You know, with her Leia buns and her Chewbacca sauce.
Absolutely.
So she's going to have to listen to this.
She will.
Her ears are burning as we speak. So, you know, so I think that a little bit of what's happening here, I shouldn't say a lot, but I do think a little bit of what's happening in this film, both with that comment, like you that you just named that he said to Rey, and also with some of the other dynamics that are happening off stage from Rey's adventure, we're going to look at the historical footnote of the Me Too movement as expression of frustration with this sort of glass ceiling that we have in many contexts, but even in Star Wars, of you have to have a certain pedigree, you have to have a certain number of Star Wars opening movie premieres under your belt, you know, to be counted as really part of the story. And because we're moving on to a new generation here, and that's what this reboot is meant to have done. It's this 2015, you know, with The Force Awakens, this new trilogy, it's meant to welcome a whole new generation of fans into this film. But we have to get past the kind of the faction of fans who want to make it a more exclusive thing and who want to have sort of ownership over it. And I don't know, you know, maybe I'm reading too much into it, but I hear some of that in it, and I hear some of that in the very much criticized, you know, role of Admiral Holdo in the movie as well. Kind of, she has to step up and demand her authority. She has to claim it for herself. She's, you know, Poe is not just going to let her, you know, what he thinks is run the resistance into the ground. She has got to step up and claim her authority for herself and get him out of her way in order to do what she thinks is best. But I mean, I hate to say it, you know, those of us who feel like we've been in that same situation, you know, probably wanted to stand up and applaud and say, you know, yeah, tell him to stop mansplaining you. Quit that. You know, do your thing. Do your thing. You're in charge.
She's hugely heroic in that. So ultimately, absolutely. So, but I was thinking about just Amy had just reminded me in a recent conversation about, I guess she'd seen a t-shirt that had Robin Wright as Princess Buttercup and Princess Leia. And then it showed Robin Wright's character in Wonder Woman. And then it showed General Organa. And it said, I'm old enough that I've seen princesses grow up to be generals. And, or princesses become, my princesses become generals, something like that. And I thought, that is very of the moment.
Absolutely.
Just made me think of that when you were talking about that.
I like that. I like that. Although, you know, I have to remember, I have to get back to my non-warish roots. I'm like, why do we need princesses and generals in the first place, you know?
Oh yeah, I know. I don't know, I'm not a big fan of aristocracy either, let me tell you. we were talking a little bit about the royal wedding, and I feel like, and you know, I'm an Anglophile, I'm a British historian, but you know, we fought a revolution, so we don't have to watch the royal wedding, thank you very much.
And what did I do at 6 a.m
oh, did Saturday? You really
turn on the royal wedding? Oh yeah.
Well, I have to say, I think it was very interesting in terms of some of the personal political stuff that was going on there, and I think the ceremony was interesting from that regard, but I can't get into all the pomp and all that, so I just can't get into it. But
I loved it. Yeah, but the homily was worth the price of admission, which was free, so that's good. And the gospel group that sang as well, they were
definitely. I mean, I saw clips, I'm not gonna lie, I did watch some clips when it seemed like it was worth seeing something. But still, I'm a little resentful of some of that, the titles and all that. I don't need to call somebody by a title. I'm American, by God. Emily, we're kind of running a little low on time here, but I want to ask the last of our Star Wars questions, which is that if you were going to, like in Star Wars fashion, we were talking about all these, you know, these additional storylines, whether it's the Han Solo storyline or whether it's Rogue One, if you were going to find another Harry Potter moment that you would want to see developed through a film or what have you, either forward in time or backward or sometime parallel, what Harry Potter moment would you want to see done in that vein? Or would you? Would you even want that?
Oh, I would. I would think it would be really great because, you know, what I would want would maybe be some Nicholas and Pernell Flamel stories. I just think that would be, there's a lot of material there. You know, they're both opera lovers.
Yeah, was it 600 years of life?
Yeah, right. You know, that they probably always didn't just hang around with their, what kind of dogs they had some kind of dogs that they loved. But But you know that they had some adventures in those 600 some years.
Yeah.
So I would love to see those. Also, I think it would be fun to see some Tonks stories. Tonks stories. Very cool. Or some Bobatons adventures, like maybe some school stories involving Bobatons. What's it like at Bobatons?
All right.
You know, what's going on? So I think those would be fun. Those were the I mean, besides, you know, everybody always says the Marauders. And I think obviously I would like that as well, but absent that, you know, I think those would be some fun options.
Side stories. What about Mad-Eye Moody?
I have some news for you that as we've been speaking, Rowling was asked, what are you writing right now? And she said, I've just finished the fourth Galbraith novel, and I'm writing a screenplay for Fantastic Beasts 3. Here's the news. After that, I'll be writing another book for children. I've been playing with the non-Harry Potter Wizarding World story for about 6 years, so it's about time I get it down on paper. We are being promised another Wizarding World story.
Novel.
Wow.
Yeah, a book.
A book.
A book.
Beautiful books.
Please, yes. Now, John, did not Adil Amini, in his original interview, did not she say something just like that, that she had some story that was sort of...
Oh, yeah. She's been talking about another children's story. I always kind of gag on when she says that. But that, she's running another story that's going to... a non-Harry Potter Wizarding World story. She says for about 6 years.
Gosh.
When rolling in her math, who knows what 6 years actually means. So I mean that's it takes usually takes her 5 years gestation and planning for any of her books. So she's right on schedule.
Wow! Oh my gosh! What a perfect bit of news to inject, right with that question.
Love it.
It's like I just asked J.K. Rowling that question. That's
right,
awesome.
Right.
All right, and the voice that she answered in was very much like John Granger's.
Well, I mean, she just put four answers to questions at jkrowling.com. Who knows when people will actually be hearing this? It'll be old news by the time I hear this. She put answers to four questions, and much of it seems to be to counter my assertions that she had really nothing to do with the play and that she is a... frustrated at that. She does say she gets frustrated with the screenwriting process, but she says right at the moment when you think never again, this is too hard, you go down to the film set and you fall in love with the process all over again. So
okay.
She's admitting frustrations and this and that, but
she's trying her hand at that kind of writing. She likes it better than maybe she thinks.
She says, as the screenwriter, the majority of my input comes at an earlier stage, that they make all the decisions. Anyway, sorry to throw in the news here, but we do have the news that Rowling is writing a Wizarding World story, non-Harry Potter, that is going to be after she finishes Fantastic Beasts 3. Not good news for those of us who are looking forward to Cormorant Strike 5, but which will come out, I assume, sometime before the Lord comes, but you know,
she's finished with four.
If the Lord
John.
Carries,
it exists.
Great acts take time.
There you go.
The crazy thing is that we're going to get Fantastic Beasts, the Fantastic Beasts screenplay, and Cormorant Strike probably in the same month. It's going to be a Christmas time release. It has to be. Hold on. Reserve some space in your fall, folks, because it's going to be a rolling avalanche.
Awesome.
Well, if it's a Nicholas Flamel story, Nicholas and Purnell.
You heard it here first.
Beer.
We heard it here first. We heard it. A dark beer, very large, cold, on me, Emily.
Oh my gosh, that's amazing. So, Emily, I really appreciate you joining us for what is our 12th episode of Reading, Writing, Rolling. Because
happy anniversary,
that's
Katie!
That's right! It represents a full year. Happy anniversary to you too, John. Now, our listeners may not be aware that when they hear our opening and closing theme, they are, in fact, listening to a song that Emily Strand herself contributed instrumental and vocal accompaniment to. We usually just play the instrumental version of the song, but as a special treat, we're going to close out the show this week with the full tune, words and all. Our wonderful technical editor Emma Nicholson contributed the very clever lyrics, which our friend Harry Potter scholar, my co-editor of Harry Potter for Nerds 2, Travis Prinzi, he provided the guitar and lead vocals. And Emily, then you polished up the mix, added in some other instruments and your own vocals. And just as a shout out to Travis, Travis also plays regularly with his band, the Travis Prinzi Band, in the, I think, the Rochester, New York area. And his band even has a website, so if you're in that area, you can check him out. We're going to close out with that, but before I leave you all with the tune, I wanted to thank you very much, Emily, for being with us on the podcast today and sharing
you're
your thoughts
welcome.
About Star Wars and Harry Potter synchronicity.
Thank you for having me.
And thank you for your contribution to our theme song.
Oh, you're welcome. That was also a pleasure. That was a great pleasure. So I'm glad it gets airtime.
Yeah, it was a lot of fun, and what a great, you were talking about collaboration before, and I thought, what an awesome collaboration that is.
That was fun, especially since there were several hundred miles between all of us doing
yeah.
it. This, the power of technology.
Hundreds of miles? Emma's
in Australia.
I know, thousands, right? And I just want to just encourage people to listen and soak in those lyrics that Emma wrote, because they really are great, and they're just such a fun piece,
fun.
The way it ended up, so...
Yeah,
she won a Hogwarts professor contest and almost a complete set of my books.
Oh, cool!
Almost,
that's great.
Almost though.
Yeah.
So thanks also, of course, to you, John Granger, our continuing expert guest. We are looking forward to our next lineup of shows for the next year. John and I are plotting away to come up with really great shows, so stay tuned for all the great topics that we have coming up. And of course, if you have ideas, we would be keen to hear them, so you can leave us a comment or question or an idea for something you'd like to hear more about, and you can do that through our email at readingwritingrolling@gmail.com. We also have a Facebook page, Reading Writing Rolling, and you can send us a message via the Facebook page too, if you'd like. A big, big thank you to our technical editor and lyricist extraordinaire in Australia, Emma Nicholson. Thank you for all you do, Emma. And our partners at MuggleNet, we very much appreciate you. MuggleNet, being the number one Harry Potter fan site, is just a wonderful platform for us to have this show. And special thanks to Amy Hogan and to the people at MuggleNet who are helping us with our social media. So now I'm going to leave you all with the wisdom of Hogwarts Headmaster and Supreme Mugwump of the International Confederation of Wizards, Albus Dumbledore, who said, "Words are, in my not-so-humble opinion, our most inexhaustible source of magic, capable of both inflicting injury and remedying it." We'll see you next time when we'll be using our words to make some magic.
Time.